Fall cleanup projects around the house can be a lot of work, with leaves to rake, gutters to clean, and wood to stack. But donating that old vehicle you no longer use to NHPR is as easy as pumpkin pie. Free up some space in your garage this autumn, all while supporting the public radio programs you rely on. We'll take care of the paperwork and even arrange to tow away your old car, truck, or boat for free. Learn more today at nhpr.org/cardonation.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Since the academic year began, the coronavirus pandemic has created new challenges for Granite State Public Schools, constantly balancing the dangers of infection versus the benefits of in-person instruction. NHPR's newsroom has been reporting on this in a series called COVID and the Classroom. And today in The Exchange, we have the first of a two-part special. We're talking with New Hampshire Education Commissioner Frank Edelblue. And then on Thursday, a panel of teachers from across the state will share their stories. Exchange listeners, what are the biggest challenges for you as an educator, a parent, or a student? What do you want the commissioner to know about what's happening in your local schools? Send us an email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook, use Twitter, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Commissioner Edelblue, welcome back to The Exchange. Good to have you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me, Laura. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, how has this pandemic, Commissioner, I don't think I've talked to you since it began, changed your department's role in public education in New Hampshire?
Well, I don't know that it's changed the role. We still have, you know, kind of a statutory role that we have to fulfill, but it has changed the work a bit in terms of how we're supporting and engaging our schools to make sure that we're providing the best opportunities possible, really, for all of the children here in New Hampshire. And so that has meant some of the things that may have been a priority before the pandemic are less of a priority, and then we're dealing with some of the other issues that the pandemic has made a priority for us, you know, really focused around supporting and making sure that we can have good, you know, rigorous opportunities for instruction and continuity of instruction. In the midst of the pandemic, in the midst of what can sometimes be really disruptive for our schools and for our families and for our students.
Wow. So you've had to set some stuff aside, maybe not forever, but for the moment. That's interesting, Commissioner. What have you been wanting to focus on, but with the pandemic, you just can't?
Well, I mean, one of the areas that we spent a lot of time on as a department before the pandemic was really working on learning opportunities for students outside of the traditional school environment. Extended learning opportunities, work-based learning opportunities, helping students to get out and get some more experiential learning opportunities, really. And what we've discovered is, particularly when we were at stay at home and now we're safer at home, a lot of that has been disrupted. And a lot of those programs have had to become really creative in terms of how to engage students. And so trying to figure out how do you pivot that and create that same opportunity, really that same experience for students to be able to get kind of really broad educational opportunities while we're also trying to be as safe as possible. One of the ways that that has happened, and the governor has been really helpful along this route, is a couple of weeks ago, I think it is, he introduced what is kind of a funding opportunity for student enrichment programs. And so we have been receiving applications for many of these learning opportunities that may have been available to students pre-pandemic, but have really kind of struggled in the pandemic to figure out how to connect. It could be the Shepherd McAuliffe Museum. It could be, you know, Girls Who Work. It could be some of our robotics programs in the state of New Hampshire. And so how does that look different in a pandemic world? So trying to make sure that we continue to create opportunities for our students, but do it in a safe way.
Wow, I can totally see that, you know, the idea of getting students out in the world, out with, you know, companies or organizations, and now those organizations are saying, nobody can come in. So it definitely,
yes, exactly.
I can see the difficulty.
A little bit
there.
Of a barrier there, right?
Right. What are some actions, Commissioner Edelblue, that you've taken or things you've had to consider that just would have been off the table before?
actions I've taken that have been off the table. I'm not, clarify that question a little bit for me, Laura.
Just
I'm not
things
exactly
that you've
sure
had
you
to, yeah, sure.
Because I'm one of those people who many people know, like, nothing's off the table for me. I think you should consider all options, right?
Well, okay, so like closing schools, I mean, there's such a tradition of local control here in New Hampshire. It was shocking for me as a mom to see you and the governor go on TV in March and say, all the schools are closing down. So things like that, where you just found yourself in a position going, wow, I can't believe I'm doing this, but here I go.
So I would just take one exception with the, Laura, your vernacular. So we didn't close any of our schools. And I think that that's an important mindset that we've brought to all this work. And obviously many of the school buildings were closed. But the implication is really that somehow, you know, learning is limited to that place. And school is really about learning. And what we want to stay focused on is the opportunities that we have for learning for our students across the state. And I often talk about the idea of continuity of learning, because we still are living in a really disrupted kind of a system. So you have schools, I mean, right where we are now, we got about 40% of our students are in-person instruction, generally 5 days a week, and sometimes 4 or 5 days a week, but in-person instruction in a traditional kind of a model. We've got hybrid models going on for about another 40%. We got 20% of those are remote. But even where we have students that are in-person in the instruction model, you have to understand that one of those students or a cohort of those students might find themselves in a circumstance that they're required to quarantine,
right?
Which means that they're going to have to be out of that learning environment, that instructional environment, for up to 14 days. And what we want to make sure is we have continuity of learning for those students. So whether it's a pandemic on March 15th, 2020, when we have to pivot to everybody is going to be going remote, or it's really a system where we have some students that are in and then maybe they have to go out for a little bit and then they're going to be back in, is that can we create a system that is nimble enough and flexible enough to be able to accommodate this very dynamic environment that we've found ourselves in? I mean, I think that's one of the most difficult things for, you know, the kind of the system as a whole, because it can be exhausting, right? To be kind of on the top of your game and being nimble and be flexible and pivoting. You know, you wake up in the morning and you're going to school and you don't know what that attendance roster is going to look like. And if you're going to have to address some circumstances, some health circumstances in your school instructional environment and have to respond to that. So just a heightened energy all the time. It can be difficult for folks.
Yeah. And we'll definitely talk a little bit later, Commissioner. I'm glad you raised that about staff burnout, because boy, that's what we're hearing from administrators and teachers. But since you mentioned 40% of schools doing in-person, roughly 40% doing some kind of hybrid model and 20% remote. That's really interesting to hear that breakdown. How much guidance are you guys at the Department of Education giving to schools about what model they might choose and when they might have to change that model?
Yeah, so the guidance that we've given to schools is really kind of into two different categories. So at the Department of Education, we spent a lot of effort working around kind of how the instruction should take place, how it should be engaged, how it should be executed. We even just recently issued another technical advisory on that to help schools kind of stay on the same page and understand what that looks like. But then we also are working really closely with the Department of Public Health, specifically with Dr. Chan and Dr. Daly, around how to do that safely. And so we've produced guidance that's really kind of a matrix for schools that looks at a couple of different factors. One is, you know, what are the community levels of transmission that are taking place where a particular school is? And then what is really the levels of, you know, transmission or viral transmission in a school environment? And we have this matrix that we've built, and schools can kind of look at what is the community transmission, what is the state of the virus in our learning environment? And we have a grid, and it says, okay, so if you have these conditions, then you can be in person. If you have these conditions, then we're recommending a hybrid. If you have certain other conditions, then we think a fully remote model might be more appropriate for your particular environment. And it's not always kind of black and white. You have this grid and it looks like it's really clear, but sometimes schools are transitioning between these different levels, you know, on a daily or a weekly basis. And so really, even as Dr. Chan describes it, these are the guidelines, and then we have to just look carefully and try and figure out where do we fit, where do we see the movement so that we can make good decisions about the type of learning environment that we want to see our schools in. And it's a regular occurrence that I'm having conversations with superintendents, with members of school boards who are calling up and saying, hey, here's what we're facing on the ground. Here's the circumstances. Here's maybe where we see ourselves in this matrix. Here's what we think is happening. You know, here's the direction that we're going. What do you think, Frank? You know, and if I'm not sure, I might even reach out to public health and say, hey, what do we think about this? But ultimately, it is a local control decision. So we're giving them the framework. We're giving them the guidance that helps them to make kind of well-informed decisions. And then ultimately, they're executing on those decisions in their local communities. And so what you'll find is that sometimes, you know, the guidance may recommend that, you know, an in-person or a hybrid model might make sense. But there may be a community says, you know what, we're not comfortable with that. So we're going to have a remote model or some other, you know, combination thereof.
So really it's a framework. It's guidance from you guys. Yeah. It's not thou shalt open or thou shalt close.
Yes. Basically. And thank you for cutting me off. You get me going here and I can't stop.
It's okay. You're the education commissioner and you like talking about education. It's all good. But I did want to ask you, Commissioner Edelblue, about a specific situation. As you know, in Nashua, some conflict down there. The superintendent is looking for another job because of disagreements with the school board over both race relations and the pandemic. He says the board was rushing reopening plans without adequately including staff and public health officials. And then there's a group of parents who are saying, please, please open our schools, holding rallies. They feel their kids are just not doing well. So what's your role, Commissioner Edelblue, in helping resolve these conflicts between parents and school staff about what's best and safest for everyone?
Right. So I have had a number of conversations with Jamal, who is the superintendent down in Nashua, about this. I've also had a number of conversations with parents that have reached out to me directly and reached out to the department to express their concerns about that learning environment and how that is or is not working for their individual children. So again, what we're doing is we're trying to say, here is the guidance about how you can safely reopen your schools. And at the end of the day, that school board is going to look at that guidance and they're going to make a determination for their local community. But those circumstances where you may have parts of the community that are really unsatisfied with maybe the direction that that school board is taking, there are certain adjudicative types of processes at the state that the parents can use. And it's usually a very structured process where they can, you know, express their concerns and they can have them heard. And then they have appellate processes where if they're not happy with the feedback that they get from their local school board, they can appeal that up to the State Board of Education, who will hear those complaints and make determinations and adjudications.
Oh, wow. So I did not know about that.
Avail these, the communities and the members of the community so that they understand really the tools that are available in order to address the concerns that they have.
Wow. So there's an adjudicative process, as you said, kind of almost like a court of appeals that parents can go to if they are really unsatisfied?
Yes. So we have certain processes. So it generally starts with a parent. And again, this is what I would encourage everybody to do. You know, many times problems can be resolved by the adults talking to one another and trying to understand and figure out and see the circumstances from both sides and coming to a conclusion that works for both of them. And that's really what we encourage people to do is, you know, if something's not working in an educational setting, you know, talk to your teacher. If it's not working with your teacher, talk to your principal and then maybe your superintendent. And there are processes, formal processes, where a parent can approach the superintendent. If they're not satisfied, then go to the local school board. If they're not satisfied there, then they can bring it to the State Board of Education to be heard. And so those processes, you know, well before the pandemic were already established. They've got, you know, they're clear about how they work and how people can engage them. But I do think that the best way to solve these problems is by the adults talking to one another and kind of working through some solutions that are going to work for everyone.
All right. Well, let's go to our listeners, Commissioner. And again, our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. If you're a teacher, administrator, parent, what do you want to talk with New Hampshire's Education Commissioner about? What issues are happening in your local public schools? What kind of help does your school need? By the way, with all the CARES Act money that's been going to schools, tell us if you think that that has been enough. Again, you can join us at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And let's go to the phones. Commissioner Jeff is calling from Deerfield. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air. Welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, and thank you for having me. I wanted to call in today. I'm a school board member in my community. Sorry.
That's okay. You get a little bit of feedback there. Yeah. Go ahead, Jeff. No problem.
So, remember, in my community, and the local control issue is something that's cited over and over again, and, you know, the state's given the control to the local communities. But in this situation, it's not applicable. And I say that because we all know how politicized this pandemic has become. And they reference the which really isn't all that helpful. It's a tool they've given us, but it's not very clear. We're making public health decisions as school board members with zero training in how to handle a pandemic. And so what we end up with is incredibly divided communities being represented by these school boards who all have their own personal opinions. You know, I'm not involved in the field of medicine. I'm not involved in virology, and I'm trying to make the best decision I can as a school board member for my entire community, which is now divided the community into thirds. You've got a third of the community that wants remote, a third that wants hybrid, and a third that wants full-time in person. And so you've got these boards representing each member representing their own personal views and opinions on it, but it's really not science-based. It's hardly fact-based, to be honest, and it's put us in a horrible position where it would be really helpful, in my opinion, if the state would come up and give us more guidance rather than just saying it's local control, everything's fine, the local boards can figure it out.
So, Jeff, you're saying, hey, I'm just a school board member. I'm not an epidemiologist. Are you saying you would like the state to tell you guys what to do instead of kind of giving you some ideas and leaving it up to you? Is that what you're saying, Jeff?
Or giving us more resources in a direct conduit where we have the resources of the state, because the little town of Deerfield doesn't have an epidemiologist to consult.
Right.
We don't have, you know, we've got a matrix to look at and say, oh, this is the transmission rate. This is what we should be doing. And at the end of the day, never mind not having access to the experts, but we have a community that's looking to us, and the lack of guidance is just, it's incredibly, incredibly challenging. And running for school board, I don't think any of us anticipated what a horrible situation we were going to be placed in making these decisions for our community.
Sure, right. You're running for school board because you care about education. You're not a public health expert. I hear you, Jeff. Thank you for calling. You know, Commissioner, he's expressing something that a lot of districts have said, that they want more guidance from the Department of Education, that the state has, quote, left them on their own. What's your thought about that, Commissioner?
So I've heard that as well, and I really appreciate that feedback. And so we, wherever anybody says we think we need some more guidance on something like this, we are pushing that out. If they're saying like, well, this part is not clear. And I want to sympathize with Jeff, because I appreciate and I thank him for running for office, because, you know, that sometimes can be a thankless task. And now on top of it, I get that Jeff never anticipated he would be dealing with a pandemic. Truthfully, I don't know if anybody anticipated that they would be dealing with a pandemic. So if there is specific guidance that Jeff is looking for, we're happy to, you know, provide clarity around that. But there are tremendous amounts of resources. And oftentimes when I hear back from folks who are thinking like, well, we need guidance around this or this, that guidance exists and we can take them to it and show them where it is. Because there is, it's a large body of information in terms of the guidance. But particularly around the public health aspects of this. You know, the department has weighed in, but as well, we've worked very closely with the Department of Public Health, Dr. Chan and Dr. Daly, and provided really those epidemiological resources to the schools and given them frameworks to help them navigate the hard decisions that have to be made. And what we really are trying to help them do is those resources and those matrices, those decision matrices, allow those districts to make decisions that are going to make sense for their communities. I think we all knew, we saw it, you know, through the spring into the summer, and then, you know, starting out school in the fall, that the conditions on the ground were vastly different across different parts of the state. You know, we saw areas of our state that had, you know, relatively high, I say relatively because even in New Hampshire, they're low compared to other parts of the country, but relatively high transmission rates. And we had other communities that had not seen one case of COVID. And so there is not a one size fits all solution to any of the problems that we're facing. And so I would just encourage Jeff, if he's got specific questions, again, I take calls all the time from school board members, from superintendents who are trying to figure out, hey, here's the circumstance. Can you help me understand how to apply the guidance in here? Or is there guidance about a specific area? We're happy to encourage and kind of weigh in on that.
Here's an email from Nathan in Chichester who says, I'm speaking on behalf of my wife. She's a school teacher in Londonderry. Our question is, why is there not any kind of weekly testing offered to the teachers? Regular and consistent testing is critical to be able to track spread and keep our kids and teachers safe. And I just add, Commissioner, I know at UNH, students and staff are getting tested twice a week. So go ahead, please.
Yeah, so another great question. And I have had conversations with Commissioner Chibonette around this. And so she, and we have now got the Binax rapid tests available in the state. And so she has made that testing pretty ubiquitous across the state and made it available for lots of people to get testing. But really it would be outside of my lane to comment on the testing protocols for our teachers specifically. And I think that that's a better question for public health than it is for the Commissioner of Education.
Well, and next week we will be talking to, again, the state's top public health doctors. So we'll throw that question to them.
Save that question for Dr. Chan. Yes.
We're going to take a very short break. When we come back, we'd love more of your emails and calls. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can comment on Facebook. You can use Twitter. More of your questions for Education Commissioner Frank Edelblue in just a moment. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. This hour, COVID and the classroom. Today's show is the first of a two-part special. We're talking with New Hampshire Education Commissioner Frank Edelblue today, and then on Thursday, a panel of teachers from across the state will share their stories. Listeners, what do you want to ask Commissioner Edelblue? What do you want him to know about how public education is going in your area? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. Commissioner, right back to our listeners, and this person didn't give a name, but has a very interesting experience. My son is in middle school and fully in person. My husband is a science teacher and in a fully in-person school, but is now remote for the holidays. I am a counselor at a high school with my students fully remote. My daughter is a junior and fully remote in a fourth school. Wow, that's a broad range of experiences. This person says, my son is as happy as can be, no problems. He's learning and catching up from last spring. My husband is exactly where he should be in curriculum and connections with students. My daughter is miserable and feels she's not learning much. Her classes are often asynchronous and behind by weeks where they should be. My students, again, she said she's a counselor at a high school, are sad and frustrated. I am working harder than ever and feeling less effective than ever. We have serious mental health issues that are on the rise and are as invisible as the coronavirus. We will be talking about this crisis after there is a vaccine. Every day, my office hears from parents and students who have never dealt with isolation and depression, and they are turning to us. This person says it's too much. We have no more places to refer to because they are all full. Schools, this person says, can be safe. My husband and son's schools are proving that. Wow. I want to thank that person for writing. And Commissioner Edelblue, what do you think?
So I think in that one family, you've encapsulated a lot of the different experiences that people are having throughout this process. And so what I think is that she's absolutely right that we need to make sure that we're cognizant of and protecting the mental health aspects of our students, many of which are feeling very isolated. And so we need to be able to continue to be able to reach out to them. we had an interesting phenomena that took place in the spring. We were able to look at data about reports to public health from the education system, which is something that we have traditionally tracked and been able to keep an eye on. And what we saw was that our teachers were actually keeping in touch with the students and had a similar number of reports into public health relative to concerns about their students. But where we saw the fall off was really in the student support services. So our school psychologists, our counselors, our school nurses, you know, had they almost went to, in one case, it went to zero, right? There were no outreaches from the support staff. And I think what it reflected was a difficulty in staying in touch and in contact with those students. So recognizing that over the summer, we put together, you know, a series of trainings for these support staff and a series of best practices to stay in touch with students and to help them stay close to them. And we roll those out to the field so that really everybody understands, although it's a different instructional environment, the importance of staying in touch with our families and staying in touch with our students for their, you know, their social and their emotional health throughout this process. Because, you know, a pandemic, again, is not something anybody anticipated. It causes a great deal of stress for so many families and trauma. And so just trying to help support them.
So in terms of support from the Department of Education, so again, recognizing that education is delivered locally here in the state, what do you do at your level, Commissioner, to assist with this need for connection to, you know, to support the mental health of students? I mean, do you guys give schools money to hire counselors? Do you provide extra technology so that existing counselors can connect better with students? I'm just wondering what that support looks like physically.
So I think it's yes, all of the above, but I would actually go back and start with what one of the areas of support is acknowledging that there is this void, right? By looking at the data and understanding what's actually happening in our system, and then providing like the trainings and the resources for the education system to be able to reach out and support those students. So that involves technology. That involves, you know, funding, additional funding to the districts to be able to support their students. Now, you know, in the additional funding that we provide to the schools, we're not dictating how that should be deployed. Each community is going to have to say, here's where our need is. And so here's how we're going to be deploying that resource. Because there are some districts that have enough resources, or their community is such that they're able to stay in touch with and support the social and the emotional needs of those students, maybe without deploying additional resources. There's other districts that needed to deploy additional resources, and so hopefully they're investing those to be able to do that.
Well, we also got a similar email from Brennan, who says, thanks for doing these shows on schooling. I'm curious about students' access to school counselors during the pandemic, especially when remote. Brennan says counselors were already overloaded and under-resourced, and I'm wondering what's being done to support them. And so I think you just answered that question, Commissioner. Here's another one from Ian, who says, what sort of guidance have you provided to the administration about how to balance the privacy of those who may be positive with COVID-19 and to help the community informed about their safety? Boy, Ian, that's a tough one, right? Because you want to know who may be positive so they don't spread the illness. On the other hand, there can be some COVID shaming. What do you think about this, Commissioner?
So really important point, and honestly, a great question, because early on in the process, what we did see is, you know, most of our communities were going to be unfamiliar with some of the privacy laws, specifically around HIPAA, and some of the disclosures that can be made. And so at times it felt like maybe the school administration was not being as transparent, because they're like, well, tell us who it is, but we're not able to tell you who it is. That's against the law, and it's against the privacy regulations that we have. And so I think that we've grown in that way, and people understand that administrators are doing what they can to make sure that their communities are safe and sharing out as much information as possible without violating those confidentiality laws. One of the things that we talk about regularly with our school leaders, and we have regular, you know, contact with our school leaders, is the importance of transparency, the importance of ongoing communication. Particularly, we've seen that, like we've seen case numbers coming up. And as we've described all along, as those case numbers come up, what you're going to find is that the communities are going to be more on edge. The levels of anxiety are going to increase. And the best way to help support those communities is to really be transparent, have a constant stream of communication so that everybody knows that we all are aware of what's going on and the actions that we're taking to make sure that we are protecting our community and moving forward with our instruction for our students.
So does transparent mean releasing names?
No, transparency doesn't necessarily mean releasing names. Because so transparency is the things that we're doing to make sure that we're protecting the school, the mitigating factors that we have put in place.
I see.
Those are the kinds of things that are transparent. And again, so people just feel better. If they know that you're being as transparent as you can within the law, then they know that they're getting as much information as you can possibly share with them without violating someone's privacy. Because we really have, HIPAA is very clear. FERPA is very clear. These are the regulations that provide us a framework for the kind and amount of information that we are able to share publicly with the communities.
Again, listeners, you can join us at 1-800-892-6477. If you're a teacher, administrator, parent, or student, what would you like to ask Education Commissioner Frank Edelblue? And what do you want to tell him about how it's been going in your schools? Again, you can join us with an email exchange at nhpr.org. Use Facebook, use Twitter. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. So, Commissioner,
hey,
we've been touching on... Yeah, go ahead.
I just want to weigh in on something, too, because I talk about transparency, and I want to put a plug in for the school dashboard that we have. It's the COVID-19 school dashboard. We've got every single school listed there. We've got active cases, recovered cases, clusters, when the cases were reported. And you can search that by your school. We're adding another enhancement that will indicate some more information around the types of instructional models that are going to be in there. And so that's the type of transparency. So people can really get a chance to see what's going on in my community as an example of transparency. And I think it's important for people to know that's there, to have the confidence that they can go look at that and see what's happening.
Let's talk about some of the financial issues that have come up, and we've touched on some of those before. For example, using CARES Act money to possibly hire more school counselors if kids are struggling. What would you say, Commissioner, the biggest financial challenge has been for schools in terms of their ability, again, to keep delivering education while keeping staff and students safe? Is it technology? Is it hiring more people? Is it cleaning? What is it?
It's going to be a little different for different systems, but I think the top two are clearly, and I'm picking from both of our domains that we've been talking about here today. So technology in terms of the delivery of instruction, and then really the cleaning and sanitation protocols in terms of the public health aspects of this virus. So those are the two areas that I think are most that I have the most conversations about in terms of where schools are looking to invest funding. And some of those supply chains, at various times have had difficulty. Fortunately, on the PPE side, we've been in pretty good shape in terms of managing that. And on the technology side, we have had difficulty. It's been a difficult circumstance across the country in terms of acquiring some of the technology. I have schools today that still have Chromebooks on order. If those orders got placed in the summer or late summer, the vendors are still having difficulty supplying those. So those are the two areas in terms of support that I think I hear about the most.
Wow. So what is a student to do if he or she is still waiting for a Chromebook?
Well, so some are waiting for Chromebooks, or some of them maybe have older technology that's a little bit slower, and so is not as effective as the instruction could be. But in all cases, we've had businesses step up and volunteer to buy computers. Maybe you couldn't get a Chromebook, but you can get some alternative device. We've been able to source refurbished devices from other states. So just trying to solve the various problems as they come up.
Even before the pandemic, Commissioner, declining enrollment was an issue we heard a lot about in the public schools due to New Hampshire's demographics. Beyond that ongoing trend, though, Commissioner, do you know yet how many more kids left public education this year for private schools or homeschooling?
So we should have those numbers available to us on right around November 15th. So we've received data from the field at this point in time, but then we have to go through a reconciliation process to make sure that we've got all the right kiddos in the right places, because it may be that a student moved from one district to another. And so we've got to make sure that we get that reconciled. As you pointed out, we typically see a decline of between 1 to 1.5% of our students just through aging out of the system, right? The demographic shift is taking place there. I do know, and I've looked at some other states, that they have seen declines. The largest I've seen is up to 7% reduction in numbers of students in those learning environments. I don't anticipate that our numbers will be that size. I think it's going to be more than normal, but not nearly that high.
How much might that decline, depending on the size, affect school funding formulas, Commissioner? As you know, local schools get money based on the number of students, and if a decent number of students have left for private schools or homeschooling, will that harm these schools financially?
Well, so what will happen is those students, when the students leave the learning environment, then the school doesn't receive the adequacy funding for them. That's the way that the state funding mechanism works. So hopefully those districts will have that information in short order. In fact, the districts kind of already know where they are because they've reported the information to us. We're just reconciling it at a statewide level. And so hopefully they can bake that in and build that into their budgeting process as they go forward and they see the number of students that they're going to be supporting in next year's education. So in this year, we pay on 1 year in arrears. So the funding that the school is receiving this year is based on last year's enrollments. And it's really going to be the funding for next year that will be based on the pandemic enrollments, if we want to use that term.
Oh, so some of those schools could get hit. Now, granted, they'll have fewer students to educate, but there are still fixed building costs, fixed staff costs. And as you know, many kids arriving at school today have special needs, English as a second language, learning challenges and so forth. So it's not necessarily a one for one ratio. You know, when one kid leaves, right, you save X dollars.
I'm an accountant, remember, Laura? Yeah, I do know about fixed costs.
I just wonder if you have any thoughts on that, you know, how districts may face that once these
declines. So I think what's going to happen is I think we now have what those enrollment numbers are going to be. And it's at this point in time that our districts are going through the budgeting process and trying to figure out what does, what kind of funding stream are we going to have next year? How many students are we going to have to support? And then we're going to build a budget around that. There has been, obviously, we've talked a little bit about it, some of the additional funding sources that we've been providing to schools this year, whether it's through the ESSER funds, through the supplementary grants. There is also a, continuing conversation at the congressional level of supporting schools further. And so we really don't know what kind of that revenue side of that equation is going to look like on the long term. But right now we're building budgets based on the numbers of students that we anticipate we're going to have to be educating.
Let's talk about students with special needs, Commissioner. You have said districts, quoting you here, must do a better job. You've said, quote, there are no prohibitions on our districts providing these in-person services. Strong and effective mitigation strategies have been developed so that in-person supports and services can be safely provided. We can and we must support our vulnerable students. That's an editorial that you wrote with the head of the Disability Rights Center here in New Hampshire. So what's the bottom line there, Commissioner? Are you saying schools must do this in person?
Well, what I'm saying is, and truthfully, it's interesting, throughout this pandemic, even in the spring, we never had a prohibition on providing in-person support services to some of the most vulnerable students that we have in our system, some of our students with individual education programs. And so we're just continuing that theme, whether we went into the summer with that theme or coming into the fall, whatever the circumstances present themselves, if you're in an in-person environment, a hybrid environment, even in a remote environment, many of my remote schools, they may be remote for the general education population, but they're still able to get those students with special needs, some of the most vulnerable students, into that learning environment to be able to properly support them. Because some of the types of services that may be required for a student with an IEP to access their education, they simply can't be done remotely. They need the in-person support services. And so we have built specific procedures for our districts about how to go about conducting that in-person support in a safe manner for both the students as well as the educators who are involved in that process. And I just want to continue, and I appreciate you know, how our schools have tried in various ways to step up. And I just want to encourage them to continue to do that, to just remember these are students who have specific vulnerabilities that we need to be able to support throughout this pandemic.
So are you strongly encouraging, Commissioner, schools to provide these services in person?
I am. Where those services are best provided in person, that's what I'm asking the schools to be able to do. Yes.
Have parents brought these complaints and concerns to you?
Sometimes parents are reaching out and feeling like they have not been able to access support services that are working for their children. And in those cases, we try to work with the school district to figure out what are the barriers and how can we help work through this to try and make sure that all of our students really are getting services that they deserve.
Because this is the law, right, Commissioner? I mean, you have to provide these services.
It is the law, yeah.
I just wonder, putting myself in the shoes of the person who normally provides these services, but maybe feels vulnerable to the virus themselves or has a family member that is vulnerable to the virus, how do you advise districts to get around that if someone, you know, is immunocompromised and really does not feel comfortable getting hands-on in person with a student?
Yeah, so it would really depend on the nature of the vulnerability. Of course, there are some educators who, because of specific health conditions that they have, that they need to be very careful about how they expose themselves. But there are other health conditions that we can put mitigating factors in place to be able to protect them so that even with the health conditions, they're able to provide some of those services. So it's really going to be on a case-by-case basis. You have to understand the health conditions and what kinds of accommodations that we're able to make to be able to support the educator, to be able to effectively support the student. But at the end of the day, we have to remember that, you know, we're all in this together, right? So we don't want to put teachers at risk, but we also want to make sure that our students get the services that they need in order to be able to thrive. I'll give you an example. I mean, I had one child, a six-year-old, who has some physical therapy in that learning environment. And during the spring period of time, they were not able to get services to the physical therapy. And mom was concerned because this student normally is doing exercises with a gait walker to help them learn how to walk. And she was concerned because the child was regressing and losing their mobility and their ability to get around and to learn how to walk because they couldn't access those services. Those are circumstances where we have to find ways to make sure that we can support those students.
Well, and we consistently hear that teachers, especially those who are also parents, doing their own, helping their own kids with education, are really on the brink of just serious burnout, Commissioner. And here we are, we're only in November. I just wonder what resources the Department of Education is offering to those educators who are just working so hard and are pretty fried.
Yeah, it was interesting. I had a conversation with the principal of a K-8 school just the other day about this. And we were just exploring, I was talking to her, I was like trying to figure out like, okay, so what's behind it so we can figure out what the solutions might be. And she described it as cognitive burnout is the thing that they're experiencing. Because they're going to work on a daily basis now and they're educating their kids, but everything is so different, right? So that there's an added level of stress. In the past, they may have been really familiar with a particular lesson plan and they could execute it almost on autopilot. There's nothing on autopilot anymore. Right. Every time they're engaging, they have to be prepared for some new circumstances. And so she described it as kind of cognitive burnout. Among a variety of different things and resources that we have put out for teachers, which you can go to ilearnnewhampshire.com and you can see a lot of the different, you know, tools and resources that are available. We've actually now started a video series. I don't know if we've actually published any of the series yet, but the idea came from some teachers who came to us and said, like, we really want these best practices out there for these teachers to help them cope with the stress and the cognitive, you know, burnout that they're experiencing about how do you, you know, continue forward in an effective way that you balance your own life with meeting the needs of all these students that, you know, the students themselves have higher needs now. And so just trying to help support them through that process, give them, the answer resides in the body more than it maybe even does at the department level, right? Like the teachers are able to work through this. So we're helping to help facilitate that, really.
And again, we've got a panel of teachers joining us on Thursday. So we will definitely talk to them about that cognitive burnout. Last question for you, Commissioner, and then we'll wrap up. We have heard that the pandemic will change public education. Definitely, it's changing it in the short term, but it will change it in the long term. And next legislative session here in New Hampshire, Republicans will control both chambers as well as the governor's office, which may make it easier for your priorities of charter schools and school choice to become a reality. So I just wonder, given all that, the pandemic and the political winds shifting here in New Hampshire, how should we expect public schools to change in the next couple of years?
Well, I think throughout this, and again, throughout the pandemic, and in a lot of conversations that I've had with teachers, with administrators, with school leaders, they're all seeing various silver linings, like, hey, here's something that we've always wanted to try, but we've never done it. And now they're able to try that. And they were trying to change some things in terms of how they approach education. And really, it revolves around how do we create options for students? Because, you know, we've heard about students who are in remote are not doing well, right? They're really struggling with the isolation, but we've got other students who are thriving in that environment and finding that they develop a whole sense of agency around their schoolwork and their lives, and they feel a lot less stress through that process. So I think what we have to do is just be open and explore all of these various changes to the instructional models that we've implemented and try and figure out how do we create pathways really for each of our students here in New Hampshire so that they can become successful.
Well, Commissioner, thank you very much for being with us. You've been generous with your time, and we'll talk to you again. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much.
That's Frank Edelblue. He is Commissioner of the New Hampshire Department of Education and a former Republican state representative. Well, coming up, we will talk briefly with NHPR education reporter Sarah Gibson. She'll fill us in on her series, COVID and the Classroom. So stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. This hour, COVID and the Classroom, an ongoing NHPR series exploring how our schools are making it through the pandemic. Today's show is the first of a two-part special. We just spoke with Education Commissioner Frank Edelblue. On Thursday, we'll hear from a panel of teachers. Right now, though, we're going to turn to NHPR's education reporter, Sarah Gibson, to talk about what we just heard and hear more about this series. And Sarah, welcome back. It's great to have you again on The Exchange.
Thanks, Laura.
So what did you hear from the commissioner in the last 45 minutes that stood out to you? We covered a lot of ground.
Yeah, we sure did. Well, I think, you know, he mentioned that in, you know, less than a week, the DOE is going to have enrollment numbers. And I've heard a lot of anxiety from superintendents about these enrollment numbers, because as we know, you know, schools in New Hampshire are largely funded by local taxpayers, but there is something called adequacy aid that comes from the state. And it is completely or largely informed by the number of students in a district. And so schools are about to set up a budget for next year. They don't know whether or not the pandemic will continue and if they need a lot of money set aside for, say, PPE and remote learning technology. But they also are asking this question of how many students are we going to have and how much adequacy money are we going to get? And Manchester, for instance, has lost, they believe, close to 800 students to homeschooling or private school or other districts. And so I think, you know, the fact that for now schools are being expected to just kind of assume that none of those kids will come back, that's going to make budget planning season rather difficult. You know, the other thing I heard was a real, you know, push for transparency by districts about what their metrics are for reopening or for moving between different models, transparency about what kind of health and safety measures they're taking. And the commissioner mentioned the COVID-19 schools dashboard, which everyone can go on to. It's being run by the school, by the state health department. And you can see how many cases are at your school. You can also see what the transmission level is like in your county of COVID-19. There is a lag to this. So if you've heard from your principal that there's a case in your school, that does not mean that the next day the COVID-19 school's dashboard is going to reflect that. It takes a little while.
Sure, because they're compiling numbers from all over the state.
Exactly.
Yeah, go ahead, Sarah.
And their contact tracing, et cetera. There was certainly discussion, and there always is, of special ed students really struggling during pandemic education, be it in a hybrid model or remote or even in person, where some of the services they typically get are harder to deliver. That's going to become even more challenging as a lot of schools look to close temporarily their buildings during the holiday season. So from Thanksgiving until maybe even MLK Day, we're seeing a lot of schools go remote because of rising COVID-19 cases and anticipated travel, which could contribute to further COVID-19 transmission. But the question districts have now is, wait, does that mean even our special ed students with significant needs need to go remote? Is truly no one allowed in the building? And that's going to mean, you know, potential, kind of COVID slide or real loss of skills and resources for the very students who, you know, need to be often in the building the most because they're, they benefit the most from in-person assistance. The last thing I'll say is, the caller Jeff from, I believe, Deerfield, talking
right.
about the school board having to become these epidemiologists overnight. I mean, we hear that, and Commissioner Edelblue said he hears that all the time. You know, people who signed up for school board duties, which are kind of a thankless job anyway, and now, they're bringing their personal opinions about the coronavirus pandemic to these really tricky, complicated public health questions. I will say, the places like Manchester and Nashua that have a public health department in that city, they can partner with the district. And so, there's constant conversation in Manchester, for instance, between the public health department and the school district about, their metric and how many cases of young people they're seeing over the last 2 weeks, what the real kind of details are in that specific town. And that's so helpful when thinking about whether or not it's safe to stay open. And other places like Deerfield or smaller communities, they don't have that public health expert. I certainly know in some places like Goffstown, for instance, the superintendent is often in touch with the fire chief or the police chief, people who are learning from the state health department where the cases are. For instance, if there's a huge spike in a town, people can say, okay, is that spike because of a long-term care facility? Or do we need to be too worried about community transmission, or is it specific to a certain place? But all of those questions are really, really tricky to figure out the answers to if you're a school board member. And I think the kind of weight of that responsibility is really profound, and it's leading to burnout among school board members, not just teachers and district leaders.
Yeah, it was really interesting to hear from Jeff, wanting more guidance from the state. And yet we do have this tradition here in New Hampshire, Sarah, as you know well, of local control. So I just wonder what you've been hearing from school board leaders. Do they want state guidance or mandates, or would they rather figure it out on their own?
It totally depends. I have heard from many district leaders and from some school board members, we could have used more guidance over the summer. So for instance, there's a metric that was released, I believe, the very beginning of September, and it helps schools think through, at what juncture you maybe go remote because of transmission levels and when you can maybe fully reopen because of impact on school transmission levels in the community. But that was released in September, and a lot of these metrics in individual school districts were created over the course of the summer. So there has been a sense that, we're kind of waiting to get more robust guidance from the state health department, and it's sometimes hard to get. I would say there's an improvement over time. I would say, the district leaders I speak to now say, we can get a hold of people at the state health department, Dr. Chan, Dr. Talbot. We're having regular, meetings, Zoom meetings with them every week. So there's an opportunity to ask questions and get some guidance. But at the end of the day, and you heard it from the commissioner, these decisions are made district to district. And part of the concern among district leaders is we've tried to make a decision with the information we have, with some support from the state, and with all the input of our, you know, school board members about what's right for this district. But parents are looking just across the town line to a different district, and that district has made really different decisions. And,
they're saying, why can't we do that? Yeah.
Exactly. It's causing a lot of tension. It's causing a lot of confusion. And frankly, it's leading to some levels of distrust by local taxpayers and parents in the ability of their district to make the choice that works for their kids, you know, because they see hundreds of different plans and have hundreds of different reopening models all around them, because we are a local control state. So that lack of consistency, that's what how New Hampshire does education. It does have kind of a ripple effect in terms of, I would say, community investment and trust in what their district is doing as opposed to the district down the road.
Wow. Well, just give us a quick taste, Sarah, of what's next for this great series, COVID in the Classroom. Topics you hope to cover, districts you hope to visit. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's kind of ongoing, and I want to give a plug. If anyone has ideas, they can send them to education@nhpr.org. We're always checking that email. You know, there's a lot of questions about how special ed students and English language learners are doing during pandemic education. We certainly want to look at that. And as I said, schools are developing their budgets for next year. That's certainly something we want to talk to people about. Some districts have actually seen savings because of remote learning. Others are saying we're spending a lot to kind of stay open and provide services to our students. So that'll
gosh.
Be interesting to see over time.
No shortage of topics for you, Sarah. It's an interesting time to be an education reporter. Thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
You're so welcome.
That's Sarah Gibson, NHPR's education reporter. And today's program was produced by Exchange producer Christina Phillips. Thanks for being with us. I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.